Dr. Frans Cronier is with us in studio for a catch-up, as so much has been happening. Frans, let's start with Mr. Steenhuisen and the whole DA issue. Now, the polls going up to before that interview that John Steenhuisen had with News 24 suggested that the DA was in for a fantastic November the 4th local elections. How are you reading the impact of that, and where might we be standing now?
Look, the Steenhuisen story and the way I've thought about it is complicated. I saw him in action ahead of the formation of the GNU, and he was excellent. And we all owe him a lot of credit for what he did there. He was often put in a very difficult situation and was magnanimous. I recall one afternoon, Mr. Ramaphosa had put him in a very difficult position, sufficient to walk away. And he understood that that wasn't an option. And I think that and he faced opposition also to the GNU in his own party, legitimate opposition. There were arguments both ways. And he pushed through that, and he helped to make the thing happen together with some of his ANC counterparts. And I think that was extremely important. I think it saved the country. I think if at that moment we'd faced the shock of an MK-EFF government, the sentiment consequences and what could have happened in the bond market and to the rand might have been irrecoverable. So he did very well. He also did very well to get to that point at all. I mean, he was the guy that led the DA when, the ANC lost and got it into government. Achievements on a scale that, you can think back to some of his predecessors, what they might have thought of that. He also took the DA to its best ever polling results and to its strongest support amongst black voters. And he deserves a lot of credit for all these things. You know, there's a habit in these things to put someone in a box and they're bad or they're good, but often, too many analysts make the world neat and tidy and easy to understand. And regrettably, I thought his performance in the agriculture ministry was very poor and caused damage to the DA brand and to the whole idea. I thought the policy was wrong-headed to centralize vaccine procurement and administration in the state. Just as a policy, it was the wrong idea. The DA should have been pressing for much more private activity as its policies would dictate. And politically, it was a bad idea because when the whole thing started going wrong, the blame would be on the state and thereby on the minister. Whereas had the private sector been told, this is how it should have been done. Hey, we need your help. Procure anything that is regulated and legitimate. Then had it not happened, just politically, you could say, hey, so it wasn't me. I told you guys to go sort it out. You didn't. And I think, therefore, Jordan Hill-Lewis was correct in the decision to remove him. And as so often, we often thought of Thabo Mbeki in a similar way that, Mbeki presides over this immense economic recovery. Growth goes to 5%, the first budget surpluses since the formation of the union, the ANC to its record, 70% of the vote almost in 2004. And at the same time, he's laying the seeds of his own destruction. The idea, a great pity, I think, how it ended, a sad even tragedy in how it's ended, and such nastiness and so on. And, you wonder how it might have been avoided, but I suppose not. It is what it is.
But his decision to do what he did, to alienate a lot of Afrikaners who voted for the DA, calling them Afrimaga, I can't understand that somebody who has full control of his faculties would make such a bad decision. Surely, at the very least, you would ask somebody whether it's a good thing or not.
Yeah. No, I know, Alec. This is the tragedy of the thing, It's the pressure, I think, that's on a person in this situation, I'm not trying to excuse it or anything, is absolutely immense. What happens to you. And I think also in some respects, the scale of it, you know, the DA was in many respects a dog that caught a car. Suddenly you were there. And suddenly you're on this global stage and on a, you know, you're under pressure and influences and the likes you might never have thought before you could even comprehend existed. I think that's harsh on anyone. I mean, how, you know, you're reminded of who was the Enoch Powell, who was actually a very great British MP. He's remembered in the wrong way for a speech he made that when he'd actually done something else in his life. And Powell said that all political careers end in failure or disgrace. And it's a, yeah, you know, you can be critical of politicians and it's necessary, but, you know, I've seen some, obviously I've encountered some, and that many of them do it at all, would dedicate their lives to that. It's like nothing else, I think. The nastiness of it, the pressure, there's nothing else like it. And it's a pity. On the MAGA stuff, of course, that was wrong because these guys here that are called MAGA, who would that be? SAKA, LIKHA, and the Solidarity Trade Union, and AfriForum, and the like. MAGA's suggested as a sort of slur, as some nasty sort of right-wing American thing. But MAGA in America is trying to draw the Afrikaners, the big contradiction why the whole thing falls apart. MAGA in America is trying to draw the Afrikaners to America and make them leave South Africa and be there. And they have reasons to do that, which are their own political reasons, the Americans. But the SAKA, LIKHA, and AfriForums and Solidarities are doing exactly the opposite thing. They are trying really hard to create circumstances that mean that there will be a sustainable future for Afrikaners in South Africa. So the idea that that there's common cause amongst them is just it's false. It's plainly false. They have, and I don't mind telling you here, because it actually now that this MAGA thing's gone so far, it needs to be said. What's called MAGA here is actually unhappy with MAGA. Well, what's called MAGA in South Africa is actually unhappy with MAGA in America, because it recognizes that it threatens the idea that there's a sustainable future for Afrikaners in South Africa, which is what the local variant of what MAGA is trying to achieve, at odds with what some of the administration in Washington is trying to do.
Quite extraordinary that, Franz. But when you then unpack the argument that John Steenhuisen had to have done something, he's not, and I actually asked William Sanderson Mayer in an interview earlier this week whether John was dim. He would know him far better than I would. And I wouldn't imagine that he was, given that what he's achieved. But where William came back, he said, no, this was a ransom note. He was threatening the DA and saying to them, unless you give me an off-ramp, I will continue doing these kind of things. Do you think that is a possibility? Is that was in Steenhuisen's head?
I don't know what was in his head. I wouldn't speculate on that. I wouldn't speculate on that. I'd say what I have said, which I've done carefully, that he was extremely good right at the start, and that the pressures and the like later became overwhelming, and the wrong decisions were taken, and now it's ended as bitterly as it has. And you know, maybe in the fullness of time, people will better understand exactly what occurred there and why it occurred. But it's a great pity. I mean, but he should. I mean, his contribution must also be remembered for that early part. If you weigh it in the balance, sort of both parts must be counted. And the early part was, you know, it's not likely put something that saved the country.
You know these guys better much better than I do. I'm much more on the business side. How does he keep a job, an important job like a deputy minister job as trade and industry, when he's tried his best, it appears, to implode or to pull down the temple on the DA, like a Samson?
Well, I don't actually sometimes know people as well as people think one might. Sometimes the DA gets the hell in with me, which is, I understand too. It's easy to do what I do relatively and, you know, say, you know, you did this right, you did this wrong. They're in the arena. So sometimes they do get a bit fed up. And I don't actually know the answer. I'm not close enough, Alec, to be able to tell you whatever the personal things were that might have gone on. One hears things, but you try and focus on the kind of hard economic and related stuff and leave the, you know, the soap opera and the
scuttlebutt. Others. Yeah. What impact will it have on the DA, though? Because running up to that interview, it did appear as though the DA had a pretty good shot coming November's elections. Is it going to hurt them?
He took the DA up to these highs. Actually puts pressure on his successor now, because he took it to very high numbers. And the best way to think about the answer to your question is to just go again back a little bit. What is going on in the country at the moment? And what's going on is that South Africa is going through a period of regime change, in the nicest sense, not a pejorative sense. And regime change is a two-step process. And step one, it's always the same. Doesn't matter where in the world. Step one is that the society loses confidence, loses the belief, in fact, that the old regime can protect its interests. And that has substantively occurred with the ANC. People have lost confidence. Hence, it's at 40% or wherever it is now. But there's step two, and the people must come to believe, the society must believe that the new regime will protect their interests. And that was very much the DA's challenge. And because step one has happened and step two hasn't really happened to the same extent, we sit in this no man's land where we are at the moment, where the ANC has let's say 40% and the DA has let's say 25%. And the only way we're going to get away from that, if we do, we might not, is either for the ANC to redevelop the belief that it once commanded, or for the DA to do that. And for the DA to do that, it has to demonstrate that in government, it is very effective, much more so than the ANC has been. And that hasn't been clear in the cabinet. You know, I mean, John's own performance wasn't good as minister. People were frustrated at him, and this foot and mouth thing was badly handled. And in the education ministry, another example, you've got a DA minister, and it's not good what's going on there. It's a mess, and it's you could argue it's making education worse than it was before, which is staggering to think it could even be possible. And then you get, you know, an example like the communications minister who's trying, sort of trapped between things to a certain extent. You get the McPherson chap who's doing quite well in some respects in fighting off corruption in government buildings. You get Leon Schreiber at Home Affairs who, you know, yeah, there's progress, but visit a Home Affairs office, as someone I know recently did. Oh boy. and the thing is, if you're the ANC now, you know you can't reform with your current leader. I mean, reform in the sense of get growth back, because the chap's not a reformer. And you're losing support to the DA. So one of your options is stop losing support. And you can either do that by making yourself better or making the DA look as bad as you. And the the challenge that DO therefore faces now on the numbers, and where John had them going, but now it has to be taken further, is to demonstrate that you can govern better. And that hasn't been demonstrated. No, not at the scale to move the dial politically to the extent that the DA might wish it to be moved. And so we are stuck in this middle ground. And a point that that's been made to the DA is when they think about how to do that, they might think this way, that they're not competing with the ANC anymore only. Well, they are, but not really. They're actually competing with something else, which is the enclave future, where South Africans who get fed up with politicians, as politicians sometimes get fed up with analysts, those South Africans think, you know what, all the politicians are more or less useless, some more than others, some less. We're actually just going to get on with it ourselves. And I'll have my own solar panels and my own water tank, and I'll join the neighborhood watch, and we'll beat the criminals to death in the streets or whatever one does. And if the DA cannot demonstrate that it governs significantly better than the ANC can, then that is where the country will go, towards more self-reliance in communities. And I think that's already happening to a significant degree. And that competitor is perhaps the more competitive competitor that the DA has to face than its adversary in the ANC.
That's a very interesting point, and it's one that you have articulated over many years now. And it certainly is something that a lot of the even financial advisors like Magnus Haystack have picked up on and said, that's where you should be putting your money, into these enclaves. But talking enclaves, what about Helen Ziller? How's your reading of her chances of taking Joburg? Because it's almost like Herman Mashaba's feeling his oats at the moment. He had a very strong interview with Chris Steyn yesterday, and he does appear to feel that Action SA is going to do very well. And of course, the animosity between him and Ziller would suggest that it might not be easy for the two of them to work together. How's Helen doing? What's your feedback?
It's very interesting, Alec. If you ask, we asked the question of voters, and we said, do you like the idea of Helen Ziller being the mayor of Cape, of Johannesburg? And two-thirds said, yes, they do. And then the question, who are you going to vote for? She gets 40%. So there's this gap. Now, how do you explain the gap? And I think the explanation is in the regime change theory, that getting someone to vote requires instilling in them the belief that if you do this, your circumstances will improve, your interests will be safeguarded. And it's likely largely the case that gap, which leaves her short of a majority in Johannesburg, arises from the fact that the belief hasn't been sufficiently instilled to date. If she's, the last I saw was about 40%, there's still a long time to go. Could easily still turn into a 50. Lots of things can happen. But it's not clear that the DA has a willing coalition partner in the city to work with. The best part, I just think, I've said this to your viewers before, the South Africa works best as an ANC-DA coalition for the time being, in the sense that the DA brings the established middle class and the ANC the aspirant middle class, and because their interests are aligned and because the rural poor live vicariously through the aspirant middle class, you actually have everyone in the coalition. But in Johannesburg, the DA doesn't really have that option, because the Gauteng and Johannesburg ANCs are these sort of rebel outposts that refuse to do the main GNU. And the Freedom Front will probably do quite well in Johannesburg, better than before, but not enough to close the gap. And, you know, the DA and the Freedom Front have their issues with each other. And between Herman and the Freedom Front, Herman Mashaba and the ASA and the Freedom Front, and maybe one or two rats and mice, you might get there, but now you've got a very fraught coalition. one that's so, I mean, I like try and see the upside in things, but I find it difficult to see that that one's going to work in the city. And the DA's got to weigh that carefully, you know, because if it gets Johannesburg and Zilla's there, it's the Colosseum. This is where how the DA governs will be demonstrated to the whole country. And if it's uninspiring, let alone a mess, that puts paid to the DA's growth prospects, and we're an enclave country, and that's what we're going to become. And so I would imagine the DA might think that if you win Johannesburg, it's best to win it with a complete majority so that you have executive control and you can make the right decisions. And I think if they had executive control, they would make the right decisions. And I think those decisions would make the city a much better place to live in and set the DA up very well for the 2029 election. But I haven't seen a number yet that puts them over the line.
Yeah, and you were the first person to talk about the brilliance of that option if it is to work out. And I recall at the time that there was a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of excitement about it. How much, though, if you take the bad, do the Charlie Munger invert thing, and if you take the stuff that's going to stop the DA from winning or the ANC from winning right now, pick it up or no longer picking up the rubbish because nobody is being paid. Treasury this morning said we're cutting off your water. Johannesburg. So that's got to be hurting those in power. But on the other hand, the Steenhuisen factor, would that hurt Helen Zille to a similar degree?
Yeah, I think it would hurt. I would say to the extent to which this whole saga suggests that the DA spends its time fighting with itself, I don't think anything irritates voters quite as much as that, particularly Johannesburg voters that don't have water and electricity at regular intervals. You match that with the idea that perhaps the DA hasn't been as effective in government as one would have hoped, and sometimes it's difficult to see the distinction between the DA and the ANC in government. That hurts further. And now these allegations around Tony Leon, which are quite absurd as far as I can understand them. I'd like to say something about that later, if I could. The damage to the DA growth, I would say, is considerable. If you're trying to create an equivalence between the DA and the ANC, you'd want to firstly create the idea that the DA is racked with infighting and cares therefore more about itself than it cares about you as the voter. So now we have infighting. You then like to create the idea that the DA is not particularly effective in the government. Well, we've got some examples of that. It doesn't govern very well. And then you'd like to create the idea that the DA is corrupt and practices state capture. And lo and behold, a week ago, this breaks onto the scene with even Mr. Ramaphosa yesterday evening, I understand, or the day before, suggesting that Tony Leon, and the attacks on Tony Leon are just a proxy attack on the DA, and a clever one in the sense that it makes the DA unsure of what to do because the attacks are on Tony Leon. So how does the DA defend itself when in the public mind, the distinction between the two is ever less important, and I think that's the intention. So I think if anyone was out there trying to create an equivalence between the two parties, they're doing a hell of a good job of achieving exactly that. And in a former era when the world was different and before Berlin Wall and things, you'd probably have got a medal somewhere for something like this. But
Tony Leon?
Tony Leon, I think is, and unless there's something I don't know, which is very unlikely, is a most decent and good and upstanding person. And I don't know much about his business, resolve, communications, except that my impression, and I've asked around, is exactly the same. And Alec, I don't, I, a young journalist called me. It was very nice, and said to me, would I comment on the allegations against Tony Leon and his firm? And I asked what those allegations were. And this person said to me, well, that he'd used his political influence to meet with cabinet ministers. And I said, okay, well, that sounds fine to me. I mean, that's pretty normal. I don't understand why that's an allegation. I mean, he runs a business that advises investors about how to talk to the government and how to talk to investors. That's a normal thing. And this person then said to me, well, where do I draw the line between what would be a legitimate sort of action and something illegitimate? And I said, well, if he'd committed a crime, I mean, it's obvious. If he'd said, give me money to make this decision or send my firm a backhander, that's easy. What has gone wrong with the world that we don't understand the difference between right and wrong anymore? It's obvious where the line exists. If you've committed a crime, then you should be prosecuted. And I said to this person, you know, surely there are a lot of examples you could write about where political actors have committed a crime in seeking to influence the minister. Why is your entire industry writing about Tony Leon as if he's committed a crime, a state capture and the like? I said, state capture wasn't the Gupta family offering advice to the minister. It was the Gupta family bribing the minister. There's a category difference here. And I don't see I mean, the allegation was made he drafted questions for a member of parliament. Well, the Institute of Race Relations used to draft Helen Suzman's questions in parliament. I mean, this is normal. If you're an expert, you'd say to the minister, here's an idea. You can ask the president or the president. You can or someone can ask the minister. This is normal. The minister is not compelled to do that. They can take whatever advice they wish to take. It's normal behavior. And then the point is made, well, the ministers were put under pressure. Well, the poor little darlings. I hope they were put under pressure by investors. And in fact, had they been put under greater pressure, the economy might be growing faster than 1%. And in an editorial recently, this media thing I work on wrote, where do people think ministers get their ideas from? Do they think they come from heaven, untouched by human thought and influence? Of course they don't. They come from the cut and thrust of ideas, the battle of ideas. There are activists that push ideas and journalists that push ideas. When private investors wish to push ideas, they often consult lobbying firms, because the lobbying firms can advise them how to deal with this government, what the minister is like, what would likely motivate the politics, what the correct means to do this is. You can't just fly into a society you don't understand and start telling the minister what to do. You seek out an expert like Tony Leon. And Tony will tell you. Look, I imagine Tony would tell you. As I understand it, you'd say, listen, this is how the politics works. These are the internal pressures. You must be sensitive about this. You don't have to be worried about that. And this would be an approach that the minister might be willing to listen to. I think that's very good. I actually think it's very important. It's a conduit between private investors and the state, a professional services conduit. And I would imagine that one run by someone like Tony Leon would have at the center of its work the best interests of the country and the society around it. So as I see it, absolutely disgraceful that suggestions to the contrary would be made about Tony Leon without any proof that a crime or at least a great ethical, I mean, let's say even short of a crime, let's say there'd been a great ethical, moral failure here. That would also be a bad thing. My evidence of that has been presented.
That brings you back to Steenhuisen's allegations and what motivated him. Was it just a politician who got terribly emotional and said, I'm going to strike back? Or was he put up to it? Is he dim? I mean, those are the questions, the obvious questions to ask. I hear what you say about Tony Leon, and if you're right, then you have to question where the instigation came from, I guess.
Well, I'm a bit out of my depth because I don't know much about Tony's firm. I know a little bit about the campaign that Steenhuisen referred to. What that was, as I understand it, and I can be corrected, but I think my understanding is good enough to say this, that a group of investors, business people who run businesses, who were very frustrated at the vaccine policy because they were suffering catastrophic losses that were terrible and knew that it could be done better, would likely have approached Tony's firm to say, help us talk to the minister about this. And that's what was done. And again, as in all these things, I think that's exactly the way to do it. I mean, if you're some kind of a, let's take another example, if you're a coal miner and you're really good at coal mining, you don't actually know how to go and talk to a cabinet minister. How do you do it? So you talk to a professional who knows. Says, oh, this is how we do it. This is the right way, and we'll help you do that. It's a similar thing, and I think John loses his job on account of the fact that the vaccine response is wrongheaded. Two things come together, I imagine.
Are you still positive? Are you still? Is this part of the maturing process of our democracy, what we're seeing now and going through now?
Yeah. I mean, look, we've just published this new set of scenarios for South Africa to 2034. And what do those say? We say that the likelihood is perhaps that no one will win a majority again, on the evidence as we read it at the moment. And that we will become an enclave society. And an enclave society is, in the relative order of things, a very good thing, because it means we will retain the capital base, much of it, the skills base, the entrepreneurial base, the employment base, certainly more than would have been the case to any other kind of idea of post-colonial society that got into a bit of political and economic trouble. Within the enclaves, we think about 15% of the population will maintain a standard of living equivalent to anything you could find in the most comfortable corners of the Western middle class. And those enclaves themselves might maintain economic growth rates of 3 or 4 or 5%. And networked together represent one of the world's greatest emerging markets of the next 20 years. I'm pretty confident on that. The fact that we'll retain the middle classes, or much of them, and are growing and prosperous ones inside the country is about the best news, because it means that we have time, that even if we don't sort out the politics for 5 years or 10 years, we won't reach that point where you evacuate the capital base and the skills base. And then in future, should you one day get reasonable politics back together, or the prospect of it, need to repatriate a diaspora, which is very hard to do. So that's the strong likelihood for us. We also think there's an up case for the country, that if Motsepe is picked as ANC leader. I watched the comments he made to a French journalist a few nights ago, and it didn't sound to me like he said he wasn't running. His words were perhaps not, but he straddled a very impressive line between confirmation and denial, when he didn't need to do either. He could have said yes or no, and he didn't. And I'm confident that there's a project around him that, if it sees its way through the ANC conference, will run. And that will take us back to 2.5% to 3% growth in short order, because that's a few simple decisions. It really is the easiest thing to do, and the ANC back to 50%. And between the enclave option and that one of Mr. Motsepe's, I think we'd already allocated about 80% plus of the probabilities. And we've got a 15% down case where the coalition goes hard left populist and the state becomes quite effective in implementing counterproductive policies, and then South Africa's in serious trouble. But no, so empirically, if you ask where are we at? And this is the stuff we share with our serious clients who invest real money, and we take that responsibility to them so seriously that if our view was run for the exits, we'd tell them, pick up your money and run. But what we're telling them on roughly an 80% probability at the moment is that between the enclaves and the upside, but skewed to the enclaves, there's a very interesting and actually quite exciting emerging market future in South Africa for the right kinds of firms, middle-class people. And their presence will cross-subsidize the balance of society and prevent it from falling off the kinds of precipice that befell other post-colonial emerging markets that got into serious trouble. So yeah, Alec, yeah, empirically, we think it's not in a bad place.
Dr. Frans Cronier, it's always good talking with you. And as you say in the common sense, you make sense of South Africa for your readers there. Well, you certainly make sense every time that we have a chance to talk together. And that has been the case once again today. Look forward to seeing more of you on BizNews TV. But I guess you're a busy guy. So we'll
do anytime. You guys are absolutely awesome. And it's always great to be here. So, yeah.
As always, thank you to Dr. Frans Cronier. I'm Alec Hogg from biznews.com.
Thanks, Alec.
Start your day a step ahead. BizNews Insider. It delivers the business stories that matter every morning straight to your inbox. Sharp, fast, and free. Subscribe now. In uncertain times, good information is priceless. The BizNews Conference is heading back to the Drakensberg. Join me, Alec Hogg, from the 11th to the 14th of August for BNC 9, Champagne Sports Resort, where it all began and where our community gathers for honest conversations, smart investing insights, and direct access to some of South Africa's sharpest minds. Come and rub shoulders with the best we've got. 28 keynote speakers, 3 days. Seats are available now. Book your seat by clicking the link in the description.